Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Counsor, and today I'm joined by an AV geek. He's the host and producer of the AV Geeks website and YouTube and Facebook shows. Skip Elsheimer, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, okay, tell us about AV Geeks. This is, I'm sure, taken from audiovisual, the sort of
audiovisual geeks. Yeah, not aviation geeks, which is a recent iteration of the AV Geek name. But yeah, like audiovisual geeks, the kid that was trusted to go to the library and pick up a projector and show films in the class. They weren't smart enough to be the teacher's pet, but they were good enough to be and trustworthy enough to be trusted with this expensive AV equipment. And so that's, I kind of picked up that name. I think it was because of Mystery Science Theater. Like, I heard an episode where they talked about AV geeks, and I was like, oh, what a great name. I love being considered a geek and kind of flaunting that. And I'd already been collecting other things. So I used to collect printing presses because I used to do a zine. I used to collect CPR dummies, marching band uniforms, you know, a variety of different things. You know, what you do when you're out of college is you do weird things. And my housemates and I got a batch of films, 500 films for $50 from an auction. And then something in my brain, the chemistry changed, and I was like, this is amazing. And I had seen, like, everything that I collect is educational or industrial films. I don't really collect TV shows or feature films. I collect that weird stuff. And I was seeing some of that on Mystery Science Theater. I thought that was interesting and goofy. But then the more I collected and the more I watched, the more I realized that, oh, these are actually really important and interesting because they capture a time and a place and an anxiety that was at the time. And I just kept doing it.
Well, we're talking about 16 millimeter film.
Right.
And this is back in the 20th century. It was bigger than home movies. Home movies were 8 millimeter and Super 8.
Right.
16 millimeter before digital, before a video, before VHS. Every school had a couple of these $2,000 projectors,
right,
like just monumentally expensive things back in the mid-20th century. And kids were allowed to thread them and play with them. It's crazy to think of nowadays.
Yeah, and so the reason why there were so many of them was because the military used them for training during World War II. So they had a surplus at the end of World War II, and so they just donated a bunch of them to schools. And at that same time, educational film companies were beginning to crop up. So, like, Chicago is what I consider the Hollywood of educational films. So, because they had some big, they had Coronet Films. Encyclopedia Britannica was the other big educational film entity. And they were all based in Chicago. And then other film companies started up in Chicago.
Everybody remembers McGraw-Hill from our generation.
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. And so these films are fascinating because they kind of talk about every possible subject that would be taught in schools, in like elementary level, like junior high, high school, college. And then what my particular favorites are the niche ones for specific occupations, like for nurses, for doctors, for police officers. Those are the ones that are really fascinating to me.
Now, you were talking about the military earlier. This is really interesting that these big, massive projectors, and these are kind of collector's items nowadays because they're indestructible. These were used to instruct GIs on everything from, you know, not getting social diseases,
right,
to the proper decorum on base.
Yeah, well, but also things like Jeep repair. You know, I have several films about how to repair, like, pneumatics. It teaches the science of pneumatics and, like, what hydraulics do and all that. And so they were covering all these different topics that were traditionally really boring. And also, that information just wasn't changing. So they realized that this was a very efficient way to relay information to lots of people. And so a lot of the people that worked for the Army Signal Corps who made these films, when they mustered out, they basically started educational film companies, or they started working for educational film companies. So all that information about how to shoot an instructional film came from the World War II.
And the military-financed films were not low-budget.
No, some of them were really high-budget, yeah.
And they had animated films by Disney artists, Warner Brothers artists. Dr. Seuss wrote a couple of them.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, there was definitely some of the Why We Fight series, which is basically about morale, building morale and talking about who the enemy is and why we're involved in this world war. That stuff is fascinating. But then I really like the stuff like for people in the military, how to avoid scams, because, you know, they were targets. Basically, you have an army base filled with a bunch of yokels who come into the big city, and then you have all these people that are trying to prey on them. And so I have films about that as well. So all that stuff is really fascinating to me.
So I want to talk some more about your collection. But first, yeah, let's go back to the educational films, because you're mentioning Mystery Science Theater. Everybody loves the heckling that the bots do on Mystery Science Theater. And they're particularly fond of the educational films about manners and social graces.
Right, right. And I consider that I think the term has changed now, but I call those social engineering films because they really teach you the mechanics of how to fit in society. And the thing is, like, when you watch them now, they're very stale. They seem very conservative, but actually that's very progressive to teach kids how to be popular, because that at some point it was just that's what kids do. And so this is teaching you, like, okay, well, this is how you interact with your fellow students to be a popular kid. And you think, well, why do schools care about that? Well, when you have kids that are alienating themselves, that aren't interested in contributing, then they supposedly become, you know, malcontents when they become adults. So they were trying to progressively address and just share some information. You know, like, hey, if you took a bath every week, you would get along better with your friends. You know, things like that. And it's just like, well, nowadays it makes sense. But, you know, I kind of question now, are those things being taught to kids? Or who's teaching them? Because now they might be taught by a soap manufacturer or a shampoo manufacturer. And they're like, well, you have to wash your hair, like, every day. Whereas I have a film about taking care of your hair. And it's like, you know, a girl should probably wash her hair every 2 weeks. And, you know, boy, like when he, you know, when he takes a bath like once a week. And it's fascinating to hear that difference. And when I show films now, people are like, wow, that's crazy. Like, wash your hair every 2 weeks? That's insane. And it's like, yeah, well, because you don't have a manufacturer who's trying to sell you shampoo.
You make an interesting point. Is back in the day when baby boom kids were in school, this was post-Depression, post-World War II, their parents really wanted to build back up the spine of the country. These educational films were being funded with government grants. You know, nowadays, all the stuff that's made for kids is commercial. It's
right.
All about
right. It's promotional.
Selling stuff, promoting stuff, getting somebody's data.
Right. And what's interesting is, like, you see the evolution of what we call a sponsored film, where a film has a sponsor that's got an agenda. And it kind of starts in the early 50s with films that are made for girls about menstruation. It's actually presented by companies that made feminine hygiene products. So, you know, here's an opportunity to educate a young girl about what's happening to her body, because there's a good chance that her mom is not telling her this, but to also put that brand in there. Because, you know, like, oh, well, we know that they're going to be menstruating for X number of decades. So if we can get our brand name in there, then we have a guaranteed customer for all that time. And so that started what I think was a trend where other educational film companies realized, like, oh, well, we can get sponsors who will help us make the films and get them distributed. Or that the sponsors themselves just make the films and get them distributed. So I have, like, an example of that is this film made by Toro Lawnmowers. And it's for kids on how to start your own lawn cutting business. And basically how you can then talk to your Toro dealer and get set up like a loan system to where you don't have to pay up front for the entire lawnmower. Like, they'll have payment plans for, like, kids. And it's like, well, yeah, that's great. You're kind of teaching like business and entrepreneurship, but it's like Toro's selling lawnmowers. So it's kind of interesting to see that.
You know, you were saying that a lot of these educational films were actually progressive. They don't seem like that nowadays. But when you're talking about feminine hygiene and menstruation, nowadays when we have certain states like Florida that are advancing legislation, one particular bill is called the Don't Say Period Bill.
Right.
You realize, oh my gosh, we're maybe taking a step back by restricting what kids can learn nowadays.
Right. Right. And that's what's really interesting. It's easy to find films that you feel like are dated or corny, but every once in a while you find a film and you're like, oh my gosh, this film needs to be shown to kids now. Like, this film got it right 60 years ago. It figured it out. It was very smart, very progressive. We just have to update the hairstyles, and then we have to show this again because this is really, they get it, and they got it then. And so in the course of me collecting, and it's been about 30 years, things keep going back and forth. The pendulum as far as what we're allowing to teach kids kind of changes, and it changes kind of in a very conservative way. But, you know, I see that even with educational films in the 80s. So in the 70s, things got a little crazy, and a little hippy-dippy. But in 1980, bam, it slaps back to this kind of really interesting conservative teaching style. And it's because that's what the nation went conservative during that time.
It was probably the late 1990s on into the early aughts that public libraries, who had these stacks and stacks of 16mm films, they suddenly started tossing them out.
Yep.
And a few collectors would buy them up. I knew a few myself. But just way too many of them went in the dumpsters.
Yep. Yep. And I was one of the people that kind of swooped in for the libraries in North Carolina, where I'm based. But I knew of big collections. There was a giant collection in Chicago that was legendary. It was like 20 pallets. And that's how the Chicago Film Archive started, is someone came in and kind of took all those in. And so they still exist in some regard. What's great is in New York Public Library still has a 16 film library that they still actively lend out. So it's still being used in some places. It's not like every library, but it is some libraries that have decided, like, you know, what's in this collection has never been put on VHS, it's never been put on DVD, it's never been streamed, and yet we have a copy of it.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Counsellor. And today we're joined by AV Geeks host and producer Skip Elsheimer. Well, you were mentioning 16mm having its centenary year. Now, when people talk about film archives, they're generally talking about 35mm or even 70mm.
Right.
So 16mm is sort of the orphan child.
Oh, I disagree. Yeah. All right. No, and of course I'm invested in it. But the fact is that, so 35 was primarily made for what was shown in big theaters. And it was primarily studios that made it. And they made feature films or fictional films. There were some instructional, but it was mostly stuff that was shown in a big theater. 16mm was awesome because the projectors were portable. And because at the time, the film stock was not combustible. So they introduced this acetate instead of nitrate to be the base. So then you didn't have to have like a booth where you had to have asbestos around it and all that. And you could take a projector and just kind of carry it around with you. So it was super portable. The other thing that was great about it is the cameras were super lightweight. So people could use them to go anywhere, shoot home movies. It was inexpensive. Shoot newsreel footage, and then even news film footage up to the 80s.
Sure, that was the source of the tagline you would hear on the evening news, film at 11.
Right.
They actually did have film, and they had processing labs in every major city that could process that film in a matter of minutes and
right.
get into the studio.
Because it was so inexpensive and mobile, and also versatile, there's a lot more 16 versus 35. And because there's also a diversity of what it covers and what you'll see on it versus what's on 35, because 35 is, it's a big investment to get the film, to get the camera, to do all that stuff. 16 was easier. And then when Super 8 or 8mm came out, that was even easier still as far as inexpensive and portable and able to capture a lot. So I would say 16 is awesome.
So what are the challenges in hanging on to 16mm films nowadays? They obviously take up a whole lot more storage than a stack of hard drives would. And you've got an aging population of collectors. I mean, you're not an old guy.
I'm not a spring chicken. But, I know you're being very kind.
But a lot of the people that you see at conventions or in the societies of collectors, what's going to happen to their collections in 10, 20, 30 years?
That's a very good question. And even my wife is asking me, like, so what happens to your collection? And so I'm trying to figure that out. I'm trying to work the university angle and see if my alma mater would be interested in taking on the collection. But in the meantime, I'm sharing it. I'm getting it out to the world. I basically collect so I can share it and show it. I know some collectors like to have it and keep it, and they keep it precious, but they don't show it to anybody. Like if you go over to their house, you'll see it. But I've always collected with the idea that I have to show this to people. And so this is why I do this show every weekday on YouTube, is I basically am showing films from my collection. And I'm also scanning them as I'm watching them.
So let's talk about that. You actually have the projector running. You can hear it in the background when you do your show.
Right.
And it's on a screen in your house. It's not...
I'm going to destroy some illusions here. I'm okay. Sorry. So that projector sound is fake. I recorded it off of one of my projectors. So when I do my shows live, I either have a pre-recorded, already digitized file, or I go and pull a film off the shelf and I put it on a film scanner that I have, and I do a 2K scan of it while I'm broadcasting it live. So I'm actually doing something that the manufacturers of the scanner are like, what are you doing? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. So I'm actually broadcasting as I'm scanning films.
So you can actually scan at the 24 frames a second rate that the film is going through the gate?
Yep. And then it just happens to have a monitor out, which I can hook into a video digitizing card. And then that gets broadcast over YouTube and Facebook and Twitch and all these other things.
Well, it's interesting to see two separate phenomena happening. One of them is that you have people who are digitizing old films and they're taking out all the scratches and the noise and the dirt. And then on the other hand, you have creators who are making new digital material and they're adding fake scratches and dirt and noise.
Yeah, that first time that happened is I have the technology to remove scratches. And so I did that for a client because I sell stock footage. That's one of the ways that I help pay the bills. And so I provided this, like, what I thought was pretty pristine looking print, digitized file. And then when I saw it, it was all scratched. They added scratches and they added dirt to it. And I was like, splice jumps. And I was like, I can't believe you did that. Like, I spent all this time to make it very nice and you didn't feel like it was authentic enough. So you had to add some filter to it. So it was frustrating, very frustrating.
So do you think at some point 16mm film is going to have the cachet of vinyl? You know, people love the warmth of vinyl and they put up with the pops and the hisses.
Yeah.
And maybe 16mm is going to have its day. It's going to get a resurgence in popularity.
I think that's happening. A lot of filmmakers like shooting on 16 because there's a graininess to it, and also because of that portability of the camera. And I also saw that somewhere in Europe, you can buy a 16mm film processing lab for about $5,000, where they give you the chemicals and they give you the processing thing and you can actually process stuff that you shot. So as long as film manufacturers like Kodak, and I think there's a couple of others that make 16 stock, as long as that still happens, then I think that we're still going to see films around. It's not going to be like the heyday where there was a film processing lab in every town, but I think that it's going to stay around for a while. Now, is it ever going to be as good as what's happening with vinyl, where, you know, record pressing plants are showing up again? I don't think so, because that's more of a consumer-based thing. Like, people will buy records, whereas with people with film, they're going to buy the film, shoot it, and then use it for their own purposes. So it's going to be a smaller market, but I'm amazed to see that some of these things are kind of popping back up.
So I'm wondering if copyright causes any challenges for...
Always. And what's happening is it's music. Because all of these educational film companies use production or library music, where, you know, you buy like a bunch of audio tapes of this background music. Well, somebody was really smart in the 2000s and figured out that they could claim all that stuff. Like, I think they did it legitimately, but maybe not. But basically, they make all this ad revenue off of production music that is at the beginning or the end of a film that I have. And sometimes, you know, I'll show something that I think is okay, and then suddenly my stream is canceled, and I realize, like, oh, well, you know, the French film board has claims it, and they stopped it. But I've done okay. I've shown more than 3,300 films, and I've done more than 800 shows, and there's only been a couple of hiccups. So I feel pretty good about it.
So you can have images that are in the public domain, and then part of it, the music or whatever, is restricted.
Right. Yeah. And it's almost always music, because music is, there's a lot of money to be made in that. And so YouTube especially, because they got slapped pretty hard for using music or having music in people's videos. I think they got sued by Universal or something like that. And so now they're extra sensitive about music, and they've set up algorithms for that. So, yeah.
If anybody out there in the audience or elsewhere in the country has 16mm films that they have stored somewhere, they might not know much about it. What advice would you give?
So you want to keep it in kind of a safe situation. It's not going to catch fire. It's not nitrate. So, but it will start to break down if the humidity fluctuates too much or if it's hot and cold. So, like, home movies tend to be in attics, basements, closets. And what you want to do is get it somewhere where the temperature is more consistent. You want to get out of any cans that could be rusting, because if they rust and get airtight, then this chemical reaction gets worse and worse, and it really breaks down the film pretty quickly. But the thing about home movies, and I've done home movie days, I think I'm on my 20th home movie day over the years. Those are important cultural artifacts, not only for the family involved, but the older those films get, the more they show us how we used to be and what we used to do and, you know, what our towns look like and what Christmas looked like. And that becomes very valuable and very important. So home movies are actually, I think, the most valuable and important thing, because there's usually just one copy of it that ever existed. So try to seek out vendors that can process and digitize home movies for you, because if you get those back on files, you can share those files with the family, you can share those files with historical societies, you can share those files with other people that might be interested in the footage that you have. A great website is centerforhomemovies.org, and they actually list places that do home movie days every year, but they also list some approved vendors that you can send stuff to. And it's not just 16, it can also be 8mm. If you're from Europe, 9.5. If you were rich, 35 occasionally. I've actually transferred some 35mm home movies. So there's resources out there. And so just make sure that they're in a safe place. And if they're beginning to get a little deteriorated, then you might want to reach out and find people to handle it for you.
Yeah, there's an annual home movie day in many towns and cities across the land.
It's magical, too. I have, when I do it, people come, they don't even bring their own home movies. They just like watching other people's home movies, because you would think it'd be boring, but it's actually fascinating. It's so voyeuristic, but it's also like, wow, yeah, I got that for Christmas. like, oh man, that's how, that's that car that they have is crazy. And we do a thing called Home Movie Day Bingo, where we play bingo based on what we're watching, and so it's a lot of fun.
And with film, you're running light through something to make it work. Film is something that if all civilization broke down, we wouldn't be able to read VHS tapes,
right,
or hard drives. We wouldn't be able to recreate the data that's on there.
Right.
But with film, you can hold that up to the light and you can figure out what that was supposed to be.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the thing about it is you just, all you need is a magnifying glass and a light source and you can see what's on film. And yeah, videotape is just grayish brown. So it's like, I don't know what this is. So that's why I like film, is that I can see it, I can hold it, I can smell it. I'm not going to say I could taste it, but I have tasted 60 millimeter film before. But yeah, it's this tactile thing. And we have a lot of it.
So what are your plans for the future? Do you have any ideas for future projects that...
Well, the big thing is I'm running out of space. So at some point, I bought a boarding house that had 10 bedrooms. And I lived in the front. And then all my films were in the back. And then I got married. And my wife was like, I don't want to be around all these stinky films. So we bought another house. But I still have the original house. But I'm running out of room. So I am looking to maybe add on to the house. Something that's not too weird to add onto a house. So it's going to be a quote-unquote garage that's actually going to be filled with film. So I'm going to move all the film back there and like work on organization, work on cooling the films, keep them in a good environment. Yeah, that's the big plan, is to build something for the films. And I've, you know, I'm always looking for other collections. So, you know, I will take on other collections sometimes. So that's the other thing that we do. And it's all related to my mission. I want whatever I get, I want to share somehow. So that's kind of the plan.
So you're going to keep on doing your shows both in person and online for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, because that's why I enjoy doing this, and why I started doing this is because I enjoyed the showmanship of it. I enjoyed the responses that I got, and I'm getting those online and I'm getting those in person now. So I'm just going to keep doing it.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. And my guest today has been AV Geeks host and producer, Skip Elsheimer. Skip, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for letting me just blather on about film.
And for our listeners who want to find out more about your projects, where can they go?
Go to avgeeks.com. That's the main website where it kind of shows what I'm doing. You can also find me on YouTube if you just type in AV space geeks. And if it's not aviation related, you'll find me.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture. Thank you.